Get ready to get your nerd on.
Kick the week off right with games, gadgets, and general geekery from the ladies of the Electric Sisterhood.
On Tuesdays, get your pop culture news and reviews with a pure Bostonian perspective on the Boston Bastard Brigade.
Geek Aggro is coming at you on Wednesdays to fill what's left of your cerebral cortex with the hottest beats to get you on your feet.
Then on Thursdays, you have me, Phil the Issues Guy, presenting the Live Issues program.
It's going down each week. Only in the land of Ash, nerdcore at its finest.
From the E3 media booth, I am very stoked right now because joining me right here is Luke Igliotti and Mike Dietz from Pencil Test Studios. We're going to be talking about a game that I am so excited for, Armor Krog. Thank you so much for joining us here on Boston Bastard Brigade.
Wow, thank you for having us.
Yeah, we're excited to be here.
Well, first off, congratulations for getting the whole Kickstarter thing happening. What was going through your minds when you guys actually succeeded in that?
Well, you know what? Actually, when we succeeded, I was at my son's baseball game. And we were getting really close, but I didn't want to miss his game. And I'd be spending days and nights at the office. I just needed some time with my family. And I was sitting in the stands, and my cell phone just went crazy. I got 50, 60 congratulations and notices all in 2 seconds. So I knew we made it. But actually, the moment our Kickstarter kicked over, I wasn't even actually watching. Although my daughter took a picture and she sent it to me.
Oh, that's nice.
But we were relieved. Mm. You know, before we did the Kickstarter, everyone who had done one of these before had told us that it's the hardest you're ever going to work for 30 days. And I kind of nodded my head and went, yeah, sure. I probably is. It really was. Because it's 24 hours a day. There's somebody in the world who needs something from you or has a question for you. And you're trying to accommodate everybody. And it was exhausting. But it was fun.
Yeah.
It was exciting.
And just to see all the love and support for people, as I was a kid, I loved The Neverhood, and to finally see something like a spiritual successor to it, stop motion animated video game, as soon as I heard about it, boom, I put down my money for it, I wanted
to
see it
happen. Thank you very much.
I needed to see this happen.
You know, we've gotten that sentiment from a lot of people, and the thing that I hope you guys understand is that as excited as you are to see another one of those games get made, that's how excited we are to make it.
Yeah.
We love doing this stuff.
Yeah, we hear from, every day, we get emails or on our forum or the Kickstarter page, and it's kind of interesting because when we were making the game all those years ago, we never even, that never crossed any of our minds, that we're going to make something, because we were just making something we loved to make.
Right.
Something we wanted to...
We're just trying to make each other laugh.
Yeah, we were trying, seriously, let's make something that we would love to do. And to hear that it's had a positive impact on people all around the world was really humbling. And so, we kind of, now we hear stories almost every day from people saying, hey man, this had a really positive effect on my life, on my youth, or and they want to share that now with the next generation of people. So, that's been a really humbling experience.
Excellent. So let me ask you, just how did Armor Krog get first started? Did Doug Tenable come to you first, or did you come to him?
My partner, Ed, who's not here, and I, we were looking for another project to work on. And I had been talking to Doug about some other non-game projects that we thought we might get together on. And it just dawned on us, Ed's been a big fan of Kickstarter, and he's the one who introduced it to me. He's followed a lot of campaigns, contributed to a lot of campaigns. We were just looking at the landscape of Kickstarter. We thought maybe that could support stop-motion animated video games. Because it was something that we wanted to do again, but honestly, it's not something publishers have been very excited about over the last 20 years.
Which is a shame, because that's where I was talking to actually a Taiwanese TV show was interviewing me, and I was talking about gaming innovation. And when Neverhood came out almost 20 years ago, that was something brand new that no one has ever attempted before.
Well, it was easier to do that stuff back then because the budgets were lower, so the risk was lower versus the return on investment. The budgets for games are so much higher now that, you know, I mean, if I was a publisher, I'd probably play it safe, too.
The irony is that in one way they're playing it safe because they're going, oh, we got to be the next big game, and they're putting all their money in that. But in a weird way, it's not playing it safe because if they spend all that money in these huge projects and those projects don't hit, I mean, I used to work at THQ years ago. Where's THQ today? Gone.
Yeah.
Because they made some big bets that didn't pay off, you know? And I think that what's amazing now is that, crowdfunding's kind of allowed for consumers, or people who want something that don't have another avenue of getting it, to actually, get the kind of products and the kind of games that they want.
Well, and you add into that just the rise of indie game development, indie developers can actually make real games now instead of demos to show publishers what they can do.
That's right.
Those two things, it was a perfect storm.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel about the whole indie gaming atmosphere right now, because that's where true innovation and where the real imaginative stories are coming from.
Yeah.
And these days, people, okay, here's your AAA shooter, Call of Duty, all that stuff. And that's all fun and stuff. But where can I play a game that not only will be amazing to play, but will make me think and look at video games as art? And something like Armor Krog is at the top of my list of something that.
Well, thanks. To go back and answer your initial question, I ended up calling Doug and saying, hey, we're thinking of doing a stop-motion video game again. We're thinking of kickstarting it. Do you want to contribute some ideas and characters to this? And he said, yes, definitely. And in about 24 hours, he had knocked out the first draft of the entire story. Most of the characters were in there. I mean, he just banged it out pretty quickly and was just emailing it to us. And like, yeah, keep it coming. So it was... the genesis of the story in the game came very, very quickly.
Wow. Just to do that in under 24 hours, that's usually it takes months for someone to come up with a story like that, but to do that in just one day.
Well, the way he works and the way a lot of people work is ideas germinate inside you for years and years. I mean, he recently did some Kickstarters for Sketchbook.
Yes.
Archive. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Actually, my friends from Wicked Anime have actually contributed to those Kickstarters.
Yeah. Okay, well, if you go back and you look at some of his sketches from 10 years ago, there's Armor Krog up in there. So it's something that he's been messing around with, and we finally found the perfect place for it.
Yeah, and then that's when all the avenues come together very quickly, and then boom, it's there,
Really cool. So tell us a little bit about Armor Krog as a game. How are you going to be able to play it? Is it going to be more puzzle based, and is it going to be like Neverhood, or are we going to see a little bit of more what we saw Skull Monkeys, or even a little bit of both?
It's definitely going to be a point and click adventure game, heavy on the puzzles, right?
Yes.
So it's a lot more Neverhood than it's not like Skull Monkeys, or it's a side scrolling platform, different pace. This is definitely very much in the vein of the Neverhood, but. It's interesting because what we can do now, I mean, the medium of stop motion animation is exactly the same. The way Mike's animating this is exactly how he animated it almost 20 years ago. But what has changed...
Which is how they animated it 100 years
ago. Exactly. Yeah. So that as an art form, it's the same. But what we do have now is that, the visual fidelity that we can actually present now. So it's basically in the same vein as the Neverhood, a point-and-click puzzle adventure game where you're solving puzzles, you're learning about, it's very story based, and we're telling a story, but what we can do now compared to what we could do visually 20 years ago is night and day. Back then we were shooting the Neverhood on these $10,000 Minoltas that were 1 megapixel, and back then that was unheard of.
We were beta testers for the first round of
That's
consumer
right.
digital SLRs.
Wow. And now, your iPhone's 8 megapixels, right? So, and also back then, from stop motion standpoint, there was no software, and you could only see one frame back.
Right.
So you could be doing, you know, whatever, 1,000 frames. You can only see one frame back. And, you know, now, you know, with the software that's available, you can actually kind of, you know, as Mike Sandeman, he can tell you, he can kind of see where he's going, how things are going.
Yeah.
Back then, it was a crapshoot. We had no idea what the shot was going to look like when you were done.
I mean, it's still stop motion where you shoot frame one and then frame two, frame three. You just go one frame at a time. But now we have the ability to play back what we've shot up until that point. So you can see how the thing's working. Mm. Back then, you didn't know. It was a different skill set.
Exactly.
Now, you brought one of the props, one of the Beaks, who is being played by Rob Paulsen, who a lot of people will be familiar as the voice of Yakko in the very popular Animaniacs. And we were talking about this earlier, and how when you try to put Beak down, he just falls over.
Yeah.
So you were talking about that you have to do like special techniques to keep Beak from being face down all the time while he's trying to talk.
Yeah, I mean, he's top heavy, so he doesn't support his own weight. So it's a pretty standard thing in stop motion to rig puppets where you've got basically a little post comes out of the back of him that's
right.
threaded in, and I can attach that to a rig.
Mm-hmm.
And even if he could support his own weight, you would use the same rig like that if you wanted to make the character jump or do something where he leaves the ground. So
right.
Tommy Knot supports his own weight.
Yes.
But when he jumps off the ground, you got to stick a bolt into his back, too, to move him up and down. The big difference between Beak and Tommy is Tommy has normal-sized feet, and he has threaded holes in his feet. So when you move him around on set, you drill holes in the set, and you're actually bolting his feet to the floor with every step. Beak obviously, he's got these pointy little feet that you couldn't do that with. So,
right.
So he gets bolted in this unmentionable place.
Right.
But Beak's also a good example of kind of what we do with stop motion is we have a real two-dimensional sensibility to it.
Mm-hmm.
So he's really a three-dimensional realization of a 2D drawing design.
Yeah.
So you don't worry about, like, will it support its own weight in 2D? You just make a nice graphic design.
Yeah.
And then when you transfer it to three dimensions, then you're dealing with physics.
Yeah,
and
right.
So you have to overcome that. But I think that's part of what gives what we're doing a charm to it. It does have kind of a two-dimensional feel to it.
Yeah.
In a graphic sensibility. Yeah.
Absolutely. And when there's a post-production, no one will see, you know, the thing right here.
Well, it's so much easier now to do the rig removal than it used to be.
Yeah, that was my next question, is it easier these days now to do a game like Armacrog compared to almost 20 years ago when you were working on The Neverhood?
Well, you know what's funny is when we did rig removal on The Neverhood, the tools to do the removal were much more clunky to use, but the resolution of our images was so much lower that it was more forgiving.
Right.
Now, the tools that we have to do rig removal, I mean, you can do, and basically you can load animation files into Photoshop now and do all the rig removal there.
Yeah.
So it makes it much easier to do the actual work, but the work is a little bit more difficult because we're working at a higher resolution, so you can see all the imperfections when you have to paint over things. So it's I'd say it's easier now.
Yeah.
But
you have to pay more attention.
But you
the perils of HD.
Yeah, you have to show up sober.
So how is production going on? I know we had to delay just for a little bit the release of it, but you know, we're patient people. We know that great work takes time.
Yeah. Well, it just came down to the point where we didn't want to cut anything and especially anything that we thought was really important. And from a design standpoint, the game's really come together nicely. The levels all make sense. This is an adventure game, even though it's point and click, you know, and puzzles. So there's a lot of, you know, the ability to backtrack and go around and we just didn't want to dismantle any of that because we kind of felt like the game right now, we're really happy the way it's all kind of, from a design standpoint, is all unrolled. So, so we said, listen, you know, let's do this right. Let's not, you know, put out something early and it's all cut up and it just doesn't feel, it doesn't flow right. So, we ended up, to accommodate for that, to make sure that we could do the game right, we sat down and we talked about it for a while and really broke down what it was going to take to get it finished in the way that we would want it to be finished, you know. And so you know, we said, okay, we pushed out a couple months, and we said that'll give us enough time to do the things that we think the game deserves, right? And at the end of the day, things that we think the fans and people that donated would appreciate us doing for the game as well.
Well, it wasn't a decision we took lightly.
No.
You know, because we feel like we have a big commitment to our backers. And I was really nervous the day that we announced them, we were going to push it back a couple of months, because I thought, oh man, I feel like I'm really letting these people down. I mean, I know we're ultimately doing this to make the best game possible, but
you just never know. And then we were just blown away by the positive, like overwhelmingly positive response we got from people. It's like, yeah, do it right. Like, hey, we waited this long, a couple more months, is it going to? And we had actually, because we, you know, in our situation, you know, we're making the spiritual successor of a game that came out 20 years ago that people played. So we were getting, like, you know, messages from people going, look, we waited 20 years for another game like this. A couple extra months is not going to change that. And that's you know, again, it's one of those constant humbling moments when you go, yeah, people, you know, want you to do the best job possible. And
I never cease to be amazed by our backers. Yeah. I don't know why I'm surprised anymore, but every time I turn around, like, they're even cooler than I think they are.
No, I say that. I just did an interview last week for this We Love Games TV channel on Twitch, and one of the things I was talking about was that, you know, traditionally in games, when you're a developer, you're really kind of disconnected from the people who are eventually going to play your game. Right, because usually there's a publisher that handles sales and marketing distribution, right?
Right.
So what happens is you work really hard. The publisher tells you, "Hey, yeah, this is our target demographic. This is what we're going to sell, and here's our whatever campaign." And then you don't hear anything. Then you move on, and like the publisher never tells you as a developer, like, "Oh, by the way, we got some emails from people." You never hear that. So what I used to do is I used to go to like GameStop or something, right, and just hang out like a fly on the wall and just listen to people like buying the game I worked on. But this experience has been really interesting because that barrier is gone. The people who are going to be playing our games, they donated at the beginning. They're there every day with you. And some people literally every day there with you on the forums. And you're getting to hear their reactions to the things, decisions you're making. So traditionally, if something, you know, push something out, you can't control that message, and as a developer, you don't know what you know, what's going to be said, you know, what the publisher's going to say, because they'll have their own reasons, and they're big companies, they have multiple projects. But for us, it's like, oh, we're going to make an announcement, and we know what the reaction, because it's right there, it's immediate. You know, our connection to the people who are going to be playing our games is immediate, and that's been a really eye-opening experience.
It's been a weird shift for me personally, because the way I like to work is, make this little thing. No, you can't see it. You can't see it. And then when it's done, go.
Here it is. Like that.
And you can't really do that this time around. So I've been trying to, and Lou prods me, give more information to people as we go. And on our forum, I've been putting some of the animations that I've done out there for people to see. And it's weird. It's weird to me because, like, to get that feedback
immediately.
Yeah.
From all around the world, too.
That's
amazing. Mike did this little gif of Beak kind of just hopping around.
Yeah.
You know? And we said, Mike, let's put it up there. Mike put it up there. And immediately, we're hearing from people all around the world, like, you know, some different age groups, kids, adults, everybody. And again, they're really appreciative of that, you know, gesture of like, hey, you know, just an update, like, hey, this is what we're doing. And so it's just a constant reminder to us that traditionally in game development, as a developer, you're separated from everybody, and you don't get to hear their reaction. So this has been eye-opening, and it's really exciting, actually, because it's like, hey, you know, we did this podcast last week, and for 2 hours, we were averaging, you know, 1,000 people listening and commenting and stuff, and they were from all over the place. It was just really a compelling situation to be in, and something new as a developer, you know?
I think it's just as how gamers have evolved as the years have progressed. We've known that, you know, something like this is something that we've been waiting for many years, and we're very grateful when we actually see people going back to create something that we have loved as, like, a kid with us now as an adult.
Right.
And it's it's very special to see that people are... We're just happy that, that games like this are coming back into existence.
Right.
And we're very grateful
for it. You and me both, brother.
Yeah, we are too. I mean, that's the thing is, like, right? Because, like, for a long time, this wasn't an option. For us as people who make these games, right?
Yeah.
And for people who, at the end of the day, fans who get to play the games. Like, this was not an option 5 years ago. This game wouldn't have been made, you know? And now with, you know, crowdfunding... and the indie games kind of, you know, revolution, that's all, it's been a perfect storm. And we, you know, I always talk about it, there's this whole convergence of cheap software and engines like Unity. You know, software and engines cheap. There's the new digital marketplace that allows you to distribute your game without the old conventional, you know, pipelines, right?
Right.
That was the part of it that I never even thought about.
Yeah.
Once we got into this and we started dealing with Steam,
Humble Bundle,
and GOG.
Even stuff like PSN, Xbox Live,
yeah.
and the Nintendo
yeah.
eShop.
Exactly. Nintendo contacted us, you know, and we were just like, oh, that's right. Like, so this whole convergence of all these things coming together have made this, like, a really exciting time for the video game industry and for indie studios to bring, you know, things that are, you know, new, you know, kind of off the mainstream, you know, art projects. You know, we always say that this is, what we're making is playable art. And that's our goal as...
Kind of our mantra.
Our mantra.
Yeah.
It's like, we at the end of the day, we want to make playable art. And now we have an avenue to do that and to reach people who want it as well, right?
Right.
A bridge that's connected us. And so it's a really exciting time in the games industry.
Yeah. And that's what I love about Kickstarter, because, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you're backing something that doesn't quite exist quite yet. I look at it as more of, hey, it's no different from when you pre-order a video game.
Yeah.
For $10-$15, you're gonna get the game, you're gonna get the final product. It's just something that I feel like from doing something like Kickstarter, it works. It lets people know that we want these games to happen.
Yeah.
And it lets publishers know that they want these games to happen.
Yeah. I think that's one of the biggest social impacts that crowdfunding has done. What it has shown is, oh, like the big publishers are going, oh, actually, people do want this stuff. And now, you know, you can't ignore that. You know, I always liken what's happening in the past 3 or 4 years in games to what happened in movies 20 years ago with the independent film revolution, right?
Absolutely.
When Tarantino was writing Pulp Fiction, or Robert Rodriguez with $5,000, a video camera, and a kick-ass script and good actors,
yep.
proved you can make a great film, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what happened? Back then, that one major movie studio had an independent films department. Now they all do, right?
Yeah.
Every single one of them, because the big movie, you know, remember, you know, El Mariachi came out, and so did Waterworld, right?
Yeah.
And Waterworld is a $170 million flop. And El Mariachi was something that cost $5,000 to make and made millions of dollars off of it. And it just woke the big publishers up that, oh, actually, there is a market. How do we change? And I would argue the music industry did it even before that.
Yes.
You know, 30 years ago, when Napster came along and digital distribution started happening, when I was in, and you know, trying to go to college for like 3 semesters, I was a music business major, and our professor said, one day, you're going to be buying music digitally, and you're just going to buy like one song at a time. And I was like, you're crazy, old man. When I spend my hard-earned money, I want a big like album. You know, I want to... And they're like, yeah, that's not how the next generation is going to consume music.
Yeah.
And sure enough...
You got your iTunes, you got Bandcamp, you got Spotify, you got all these places.
And I actually believe the games industry, we're always behind when it comes to the entertainment, you know, industries. And we're actually experiencing that transition the past 3, 4, maybe 5 years.
I feel like storytelling-wise, you guys have evolved more than movies or television. These days, a lot more people are looking for great stories. They're finding it in two places. One, you're finding it in video games, and I will argue, too, you'll find it in anime as well.
Yeah.
In those two areas, you're going to find the best stories. Not in movies, not in TV. You're going to find it in those two different avenues.
Well, I do agree, and I've always felt this. The reason why what we do is really difficult is because it's an interactive experience. Where, like, in a movie, or I was in a band when I was a kid, like, making music, I used to say, was easy. Because I got to hang out with my friends, write whatever I wanted. And then when I when I recorded and you listen to it, you just got to listen to it. And if you didn't like it, fine, but you couldn't manipulate it. Right? But video games is like, here's my art. And by the way, here you go. And now you get to interact with it and manipulate it. So it's infinitely harder to get the end result across. And I think that, you know, that's why we're kind of forced to think of stories from a design standpoint. Because if we tell a story, you can manipulate it. So I kind of feel like we've been forced as an interactive industry to really evolve storytelling just because the interactive side of it doesn't exist in movies and TV and even music. Because music is storytelling as well, just in smaller, digestible forms.
Unless, of course, it's like a big concept album.
Sure, like Pink Floyd, right?
Right.
The Wall. Like, that's a great story. You know?
That's,
like,
that's my favorite album, by the way.
There you go. Like, I you know, I still go see that. But again, you know, I'm sitting there watching Pink Floyd live, and I'm enjoying it, and I'm going, but I can't walk up to what's his name?
Roger Waters.
Roger Waters, and go, by the way, hand that over. What if I did this? Or how about I put you on top of a flotational... You know,
how about I put you on top of the pig instead of you down
right.
here?
Right. What happens if I put you underwater? Waters? You know, like, you can't do that. But in games, you can do that. You know, you're giving people that option. And I think that, you know, storytelling, we've kind of been forced to make sure that we are accounting for a lot more variables in our storytelling. So, yeah, maybe that's really pushed the way we've evolved, or the speed we've evolved at.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I feel like there's a lot of lazy storytelling in games where we're telling stories to the detriment of the gameplay.
Oh, for that can definitely happen.
And when I see a game that tells a story and it has great gameplay, then it's working.
Yeah,
there's so few of those out there.
I think that's what, I guess that's my point, is that the interactive storytelling is really hard to do. And you'll play a game where, like, the story's tight, but the gameplay's no good. And that's a limited experience. It's not great. And other games, if it's just a bunch of mechanics and there's nothing, you know, story there, if you're telling a story-based game, then that suffers. It's really this convergence point where if you hit it, but to my point, it's just really, really difficult to do.
Yeah, it brings to mind I'll give you like an example, one AAA title and an indie title. First off, there was one that Bethesda released, which was Rage. And it was a great game, but its storyline was just terrible. It was lazy. It made you ask more questions than they actually answered. And then on the other side, with the indie title, Dust and Elysian Tale. This was a game that was made by just one person. And it had great gameplay elements and one of the most beautiful stories I'd come across on that current gen at the time. Rage didn't even make my top 10 list. Whereas Dust and Elysian Tale took the game of the year for me.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it's not, the one thing that video game industry was saying for years was that volume meant quality, right? And it was, I remember when, you know, when we were in Neverhood, there was like, 12 of us? I think we might have bloated to 14 at one point. But then I ended up, immediately after the Neverhood, going to work on the Bond license. And I walked in, and there was 65 people. And they're like, you're going to manage this team now. And I remember going, okay. And then I went to Rockstar, you know, and you're talking about hundreds of people in various locations coordinating together. And I just remember going, how are we going to make this a cohesive vision? How do you... So for a long time, I think the big misconception was throw bodies at it. And that happened. There was a time frame in the games industry where, you know, 250 people on a project became, that's what you have to do to make games. And it's just a farce. It's not true. If anything, it's more difficult.
Well, too many cooks.
I've sat on steering committees at studios that I won't name where we've had these conversations where we said, okay, we have X amount of bodies and we're making X amount of money. So if we have X times 2 bodies, we will double our revenue.
No, I think you'll make half the revenue.
You'll double your costs.
So, I said, wait, are you serious? And they were serious.
No, I remember those days of like, there was actually a really naive thought. But I think, look at... Again, indie games kind of says, you know, like there's one guy or a few guys that share a vision, and, you know, it doesn't take much to go from concept to to a playable, a vertical slice now, because all these scenes are converging. And I actually think it's easier to tell a story when, you know, and I've been managing teams for a long time. It's just common sense. If I've got 20 people who have to all stay focused on the vision, and you know, it's easier than trying to control 200 people. I think because smaller teams can make games now, you know,
yes,
you're getting better stories. More cohesive visions are coming out, you know.
And I agree 100% with that, man. Absolutely. So with Armor Crog still in production and everything, I got to ask this, because you got it coming out for the PC, and you have it coming out for the Mac, and you're also having it come out for the Wii U, and that's the one that I personally was the one that put the money towards for that,
yeah,
for on Kickstarter. How is the Wii U experience going to be different from the PC and Mac one?
Well, there's definitely, you know, obviously mechanics that are going to take the gamepad, you know, into consideration. There's going to be very specific game features for the Wii U version that obviously take advantage of the unique, you know, hardware for the Wii U, right? So I don't want to give too much away of what we're going to do, but there'll be features that just won't exist on the PC and Mac version that are specifically to take advantage of the Wii U hardware.
And there'll be some features that do exist on the Mac.
Oh, yeah.
PC version, but they'll be kind of hyper-enhanced.
Yeah, re-envisioned in a way for the Wii U specifically. And that's how we kind of look at all hardware. Like, if there's something, if we're going to partner with somebody, you know, and they've got hardware that has something, that does something unique, it's kind of our challenge as designers, you know, to go, oh, cool, how can we do something meaningful with the specs of the hardware that's given to us, so it doesn't feel gratuitous, you know. And the Wii U was a great opportunity for us to go, oh, great, look, Nintendo's always been unique with its approach to its hardware, you know.
Right.
You remember when the Wii came out, I remember going, what? You know,
motion control,
what is this? And I got a Wii, and I had the bundle that, you know, the Wii Sports, and I went, I remember grabbing and playing the baseball game and going, oh, okay, I got it. I get this. And, you know, Nintendo's always been really innovative when it comes to... So as a designer and a game developer, for us, it's a really fun challenge to go, okay, what can we do that really leverages the unique properties of the hardware? So you know, with Nintendo, it's always a fun challenge.
Very cool. So with Armor Crog coming out very soon, like, for all of our listeners out there, I wouldn't say what the 100% expect. What can you maybe, like, tease people as to what you're going to bring to Armor Crog?
Wow, tease people. Well, it's interesting because in some ways, because, you know, it's the spiritual successor of the Neverhood, people who are fans of the Neverhood are going to recognize it right away. Like, there'll be an affinity, you know, this kind of attachment they have.
There's a few things we've thrown in there that are kind of...
nuts. Yeah, we definitely... Okay, there you go. There's a little tease. Like, there's definitely some... If you're a fan of the Neverhood, there's some inside jokes that people who are fans of the Neverhood are going to go, oh, that's hilarious. That's actually a nod to an experience they might have had. And I don't want to give any of those away, but we definitely...
Well, I will give one thing away.
Yeah.
That there will not be a 35-screen hall that you have to walk down.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
And there won't be a putt-putt pod that goes so slow that you want to yank your eyes out in it. There'll be other forms of transportation that are much quicker.
Yeah.
That is great to hear. That is great to hear, because I think all of us out there are happy to hear that we won't have to go through that. I don't want to call it a nightmare, but...
Yeah.
You know, when we were making that game and we were testing it and we were just working around the clock, I can remember testing that section of the game and actually falling asleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, 18 screens into that.
Yeah.
And then waking up 20 minutes later and my hand's still on the mouse clicking.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was this weird kind of delirium you're in. You know, like, we were working, you know, 7 days a week. Like, you know, crunch time.
Right.
Typical crunch time. And I just remember not going home for like 3 weeks, because we had a shower at work and a couch.
Well, we had a bed.
We had a fold-out bed. And so, like, you're there, and you're living and breathing it every day, and all of a sudden things that were probably not cool, like the Hall of Records, were, like, normal to you? Like, I remember just clicking through.
No, I want to go on record as saying that I fought that.
You did?
from day one.
Okay, Mike was always kind of like, we used to call him like the dad of the studio. Like, he was the guy that like, you know, oh, you know, it'd be fun, let's jump off the roof and see if we don't get hurt. Like, Mike would be the one that said, now, boys, is that a good idea? And we'd be like, oh, I guess not, you know. So, like, yeah, Mike, whenever we were doing something ridiculous, Mike would, or like, we had pogo, remember the pogo sticks?
Well, I bought one for Stevie.
That's right. And, like, we did the soda challenge. People heard about the soda challenge. Who can drink 4 liters of rotten strawberry soda in under an hour got $1,000. And Mike was the one going, yeah, I don't think it's a good idea. But we were like, screw you, man. We're going to do it anyways. $1,000. And, yeah, we paid the prices. So sometimes we listen to Mike, but hardly ever.
You know what? I'll say this. Rotten strawberry soda still sounds better than a regular can of Moxie.
Yeah.
Try drinking a can of Moxie. I think you should get $1,000 for that.
Yeah.
No thanks.
Hey, Lou, Mike, thank you so much for joining me here on this special episode of Boston Bastard Brigade.
Evan, thank you, man. We appreciate it.
Armor Crog coming out later this year, 2014, on PC, Mac, Linux?
Yep.
Linux and the Wii U. It was a privilege, man. I am so stoked for this game, and I hope all of you listeners out there will go out and support it when it comes out as well.
Awesome. Thank you for your support, man. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.